This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today we're going to be talking about Israel and Lebanon, and with me to discuss this thorny issue is Kathy Sultan, author of Tragedy in South Lebanon, the Israeli-Hezbollah War of 2006. Kathy Sultan, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you very much, man.
Give me a little bit of your background. I know you married a Lebanese physician. How did that happen?
I did. I was, as a youth, quite a rebel. I'm the oldest of five children. I grew up in Washington, D.C. I always had a spirited, adventuresome, I guess, rebellious nature, and I wanted more than I thought that my very narrow-minded parents, at least that's what I thought at the time, could give me or offer me, and I met this handsome Lebanese physician, and I thought he was my ticket out. And in fact, he was. 43 years later, we're still married. We have two wonderful children, 41 and 40. And we moved to Beirut, Lebanon in 1969 when he finished his medical training, part of which was done in Madison. That's my connection to Wisconsin at University Hospitals from 68 to 69. And we lived the ideal life for quite a few years until tragedy struck us in April of 1975 when civil war broke out in Beirut.
And how long did you live in Beirut while the civil war was raging?
8 years.
And how harrowing was that?
It was extremely difficult. But what's interesting is that if one lives in war, one becomes accustomed to war. One learns to live in this kind of chaos, and this eventually becomes normal life. And that, I think, was what made it so scary, because when we eventually left, and not for any reason of our own, it simply meant that in August, September 1st of 1983, when the children and I were due to go back to Beirut after a two-month visit to the stateside, because my daughter had a serious depression, because of 82 when the Israelis bombed Beirut, because of 83, constant war, etc., we were supposed to go back home, and the airport closed in Beirut, and we were forced to stay in the States. At that time, we were on the East Coast in D.C. at my parents'. We ultimately had to move to Boston to my brother-in-law's and wait 6 months for my husband to join us, thinking that as soon as things calmed down in Beirut, we would go back. That didn't happen. My husband joined us in March of 84, and he contacted his former boss in Madison, Dr. John Morrissey, and Morrissey called back the next day and said, I found you a place in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and that's where we've been for the past 25 years.
How did your daughter get over that war-induced depression?
With great difficulty. It took her, at least probably 10 years. At first, it was medication. And fortunately, she's a very strong person. I like to think that it comes from her solid Irish background with a little bit of Lebanese sprinkled in there. And she moved to Europe to finish her university, met an Italian, and she married him. She shouldn't have. She stayed married to him for 7 years. She knew she had made a mistake, but in the meantime, she had cured herself by doing Reiki and taking herself off of all medications, and she ultimately became whole and very healthy.
Hmm. Now, I read that you had left Lebanon in an apple boat. Is that right?
Yes, that was our first time we left Beirut. That was in 1976, a year after the Civil War began. The four of us felt that it was intolerable, the war. We lived on the green zone. Our apartment was on the green zone. And in that first year, we probably had 33 ceasefires just in Beirut itself. Ultimately, through those 8 years, we had to leave our house 11 times, coming back each time to a bombed-out apartment and no windows, etc. But in that particular instance, my father-in-law, who had a business in Latakia in Syria, sent word that he wanted us out of Beirut for safety reasons, and the only opportunity we had was to leave on an Apple boat. And it was a boat that my father-in-law knew the captain, and the captain gave us his room. And we spent an early evening till next morning, mid-morning, when we traveled up the Mediterranean to Latakia. As soon as we got there, my husband was arrested because he was born in Syria. He was declared a deserter, even though my father-in-law had paid the requisite fine for those who didn't want to serve. And at the time, my husband was in his mid-40s, assumed that this would no longer be a problem going into Syria. It took a couple of days to get him out.
Was he mistreated in prison?
No, not at all. Thanks to my father-in-law. But that was only the first time he was arrested. He was subsequently arrested a second time. And that was a year later when we came to Madison in 76. I stayed for a year. And during that year, the Civil War stopped, or at least we thought it did. Things were calm. And our friends were in Beirut saying, oh, we spent the whole year on the beach and things are great. There's sun. And here in Madison, he'd almost gotten frostbite trying to get to the hospital early one morning to do his medical rounds, and he'd see these people coming back from Hawaii that were tan, and they'd say, oh, we spent a whole week. And he was thinking, a week? I can live practically all year long in Beirut in the sun. And so these were lots of reasons, aside from family and friends, that we decided to go back. And that's when he ran into problems again.
And he managed to get out of that.
Yes, he did, by the skin of his teeth.
I'm speaking with Kathy Sultan, who's the author of Tragedy in South Lebanon, the Israeli Hezbollah War of 2006. She's also written a couple other books, including A Beirut Heart, which talks about how difficult life was there during the Civil War for her, and another book, Israeli and Palestinian Voices. Kathy Sultan, tell me why you decided to write this new book, Tragedy in South Lebanon.
I was outraged by the disproportionate attack on Lebanon by the Israelis. As a close follower of Lebanon, I understood that there were and had been many border skirmishes. There had been many tit-for-tat reprisals. That was more or less understandable. That's how business was done on the Lebanese-Israeli border. In fact, even Ariel Sharon in the past had agreed to do prisoner exchanges no later than 2004. But I guess everyone assumed, including Hezbollah, or so they say, that this would have been at the time just another little border exchange. However, that's not what happened. And I think everyone was taken quite by surprise when the Israelis made a statement within the first 24 hours of the war that they were going to bomb Lebanon back to the Stone Age. And I think having lived through the Civil War, knowing what it means to have bombs falling around you, I was almost reliving the Civil War again. And it was extremely difficult for any of us. I mean, my son, he lives in Mexico with his family. My daughter's in Rome. And we talk constantly. And we all felt the same way. We were just, it was as if it was happening to us. And to see how the war was treated here made me so angry. I just felt that I absolutely had to write, and part of it was certainly therapy for me, but it was also certainly outrage and passion for the people in a country that I love dearly, but just total outrage at how the war was handled here, how it was conducted. An example would be CNN talking about, and I don't even watch TV, but I wanted certain images, so I'd occasionally turn on the TV. And I'd hear a reporter in Beirut talking about the southern suburbs of Beirut as a Hezbollah stronghold. Well, it's not just a stronghold of Hezbollah. They happen to have an office in the southern suburbs of Beirut, but it's where people live. And these are human beings. But the way this journalist spoke, it was as if, well, it's all right to be bombing that section of town because, after all, these are all just Hezbollah supporters. And that just went beyond the pale. That was a red line that was stepped over, and it was totally unacceptable.
Why did Israel decide to go ahead and attack Lebanon when, as you say, most people, including Hezbollah, thought that this was just going to be another prisoner exchange?
I did a lot of research for this particular book, and I came to find out that this was a war that there was a war that was in, that was already prepared. Some say it was 3 months prior. Some say a year before. There were already Israeli military experts visiting the Pentagon with a PowerPoint presentation talking about the future war with Hezbollah. Other than the investigative journalists like Seymour Hersh and others who talk about this with some authority, I cannot say in absolute certainty that this was the case. However, that could be business as usual when it comes to Israel and its neighbors, and particularly with Lebanon, because this is certainly not the first time that Israel has prepared months, years in advance, a particular invasion. And I would refer to the 1982 invasion, which had been prepared at least a year ahead of time. So I think this was a war that they intended to fight one day or another with Hezbollah. And Hezbollah gave them the opportunity, very stupidly on their part, particularly since this was a summer, 2006 was a summer that everyone anticipated in Lebanon. Tourist season, the time to get back after so many years of war and recovery. I mean, the Civil War lasted for 15 years, and then again there were more wars. The Michel Aoun and the Syrians, there was just constant turmoil, so everyone looked forward to this. And in fact, according to Augustus Norton, a professor from BU had just released a book on Hezbollah, he said that Hezbollah had promised, and I made this reference in the book, that they had promised that they would behave themselves that summer. So, you know, while the Israelis acted totally disproportionately, Hezbollah also committed grave errors.
I'm speaking with Kathy Sultan, who's the author of Tragedy in South Lebanon, the Israeli-Hezbollah War of 2006. One of the things I like about this book is your unwillingness to apologize for or romanticize Hezbollah. And I do find that some people on the progressive side here in the United States, and maybe in Europe too, though I haven't been there in ages, fall into that trap. Do you sense that sometimes?
I think that's the case. I find a lot of people in Lebanon falling into that trap. Not a lot of people in my husband's family. In fact, we have very serious political discussions that border on outright fights when it comes to discussing Hezbollah or the march. The March 15th, can't even remember which date this, the pro-American Senor Hariri government. But I think that in Lebanon, it's you either fall into one camp or the other. And I don't think that they have the perspective or the ability to see both sides and to be able to criticize both sides. And I can understand that because I live there. And when you're in conflict, you tend to put yourself in a little box for protective reasons. It's survival tactics. And you tend to adhere to one side or the other. I worked for the right-wing phalangist militia when the Civil War broke out in Beirut. So I'm a person who has gone from extreme right-wing to, fortunately, being progressive and certainly left of center when it comes to discussing politics. But I also credit myself with having finally been able to step out of that box and to see the whole picture. And I think that gave me the ability to be able to criticize everyone, because the only people who are innocent in a conflict are the people who are dying or at the receiving end of a rocket.
And there were human rights violations on both sides here. Why don't you describe some of those? And they were disproportionate in that Israel killed many, many more civilians than Hezbollah did. But why don't you talk about some of the human rights violations on both sides?
Well, I can talk about, first of all, the number of casualties. There were 139 Israelis, and there were 39 Israelis killed, and there were 119 Israeli soldiers killed. There were approximately 158. I've learned since then that the number could have gone up to 184 Hezbollah fighters, but there were approximately 1,400 Lebanese civilians and over 4,000 Lebanese civilians who were seriously wounded. That in and of itself speaks of who was disproportionate in their responses. However, Hezbollah was not innocent of anything. They sent over 4,000 Katyusha rockets into northern Israel, and a lot of their rockets had I don't claim to understand the mechanisms of the bombs, but they were just as offensive when it fell on civilian areas and population centers, and as destructive when it came to human injuries as the rockets that and the cluster bombs that Israel dropped. And I think, in fact, that Hezbollah also used cluster bombs. I think that Franklin Lamb makes reference to that in one of his articles. So there was definitely human rights violations on both sides, but certainly disproportionately on the Israeli side.
And Human Rights Watch criticized Israel for those disproportionate responses, and particularly for the use of cluster bombs.
Absolutely.
And you have in your book two accounts. One of the great things about this book, which is called Tragedy in South Lebanon by Kathy Salton, my guest today, is that you have actual firsthand accounts from several different kinds of people, including at least two in relation to this issue of cluster bombs. One is a woman who was a victim of a cluster bomb, and another is a cluster bomb sweeper, which has got to be one of the most dangerous jobs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How did you locate these people?
Well, I have friends all over Lebanon, and I love Lebanon. I visit it at least 3 or 4 times a year, and I don't limit myself to, say, the Christian area or any area. I have, as I said, I have a lot of friends in South Lebanon. That's how I got the interview with the Hezbollah fighter. And I relied on, actually, an exchange student who spent a year in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, a Shiite from South Lebanon. And I was there a couple of years ago, and I met his family, and I spent time with him in the South. And when I needed to get to where I needed to get, if I couldn't physically be there, I emailed Qasem and asked for his help.
Now, another set of interviews that you did for this book, Tragedy in South Lebanon, was an amazing parallel, and that is a parallel of an Israeli soldier and a Hezbollah fighter who were both in the same battle. Why don't you describe the battle a little bit and maybe give us an account of how they saw it from their respective angles?
First, it was an extraordinary stroke of luck, Matt, that I was able to First, I got the Hezbollah fighter just because he's somebody that I know, and I haven't actually met him, but I've talked to him on the phone many times, and it was an absolutely extraordinary stroke of luck that I was able to find an Israeli soldier, because I have a lot of Israeli friends, who directed me to this person, and that they could both describe from their perspectives the Battle of Bint Ishbael. The Battle of Bint Ishbael is a small. Village in South Lebanon, about 8 kilometers from the Israeli border. And when I saw it last November, that was maybe the second time I'd seen it since the war stopped. You look at it from the top of the hill, and you see the whole center of the town that is totally gone. And there are over 800 houses that are buildings that were destroyed by the Israelis in Bint Ishbael. They chose Bint Ishbael because it had been the center where Hezbollah boasted held a parade, a celebratory event after Hezbollah, in part, I mean, and I say in part, I'll explain that in a second, that they chased the Israelis out of South Lebanon in May of 2000 after a 22-year illegal occupation. In part, it was also due, by the way, to the Four Mothers movement in Israel, a group of mothers who had been sick and tired, not because the soldiers were in South Lebanon violating international law and brutally oppressing villages, large swaths of South Lebanon, but because their sons, their brothers, their uncles, their husbands were dying in South Lebanon. So they were also in large part responsible for forcing Ehud Barak, who was the prime minister at the time, for leaving South Lebanon. But this particular battle was very ferocious. It was on the Israeli side. It was a battle that the Israeli military, at least in Tel Aviv, was boasting that they would take Bint Ishbael. And there were days, this battle went on for days, but it was also a tragedy for the Israeli soldiers, because they lost so many men there. And retrospectively, when people, Israelis in particular, have studied this war, and they have said that if you want to win a war, you at least respect your enemy. And in this case, the Israelis were so arrogant and so disdainful of the Hezbollah fighters, and not even remembering that they had been chased from South Lebanon by these guerrilla fighters who knew every single rock. They knew where every single, practically every single flower where it grew. I mean, they were so intimately connected to the ground and to the terrain and to hiding places in the south. And these poor Israeli soldiers were really essentially sent in to practically be slaughtered.
It was an ambush almost.
Yes, it was.
Because the Hezbollah fighter says, we had scouted them day
and
night.
We knew what they were doing.
We knew exactly. There were a couple dozen entrances, and we knew they'd only use three, possibly three.
It was brilliantly conducted, their end of the war, if one has to even qualify a war. But the way it was conducted on the part of the Hezbollah fighters was brilliant.
But the problem with the way the war has been treated in Israel, to the extent that I understand it, is that many Israelis, especially in government, have concluded that it was a military problem, that they didn't prepare enough militarily. Not that the whole idea was wrong, but the execution was wrong.
That was also something that I found outrageous. There was never a discussion in Israeli press, except for someone like Amir Haas or Gideon Levy or someone of that level of consciousness. But in general, the Israeli press they didn't even question that 1,400 Lebanese people had died. They didn't question the morality of this war. They were very upset that their military hadn't won the war. So much so that the Jerusalem Post said, we only name wars we've won. So therefore, this war will be called Lebanon's Second War.
The war that
didn't
exist.
What level of arrogance is that?
Now, I was interested in a remark by the Israeli soldier who gave his account there, because at the end he said, why were we dying for Olmert? Why were we putting our lives on the line for Olmert and Bush? And I'm interested in the role of the U.S. government here, because earlier in the book you said in the Arabic countries, this was viewed as the proxy U.S.-Iranian war.
Yes.
And here you have a U.S. soldier saying, why are they at risk for Bush?
No, this was an Israeli soldier saying
right.
that. Yeah.
And so you have it on both sides that there were idea anyway that the United States government was behind it. To what extent was the U.S. behind Israeli attack on Hezbollah in 2006, and why?
Well, I think I quote in the book a woman whose husband was a deputy assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney. Right this minute, I can't think of what his name is, but he...
Wormser,
yes. And Mrs. Wormser was teaching at the time at Johns Hopkins, but she's also part of the neocon establishment. She is very introduced into Israeli military society and Israeli society at large. And she made the statement that they encouraged the American government not to call for a ceasefire because they wanted not only to defeat Hezbollah, but ultimately to bring Syria into the war. So there was the intent all along of the Israelis to try to drag this out. But I think that this was this Wormser was speaking as part of the inner circle of Dick Cheney. And if you recall, when Condoleezza Rice was in the Middle East, and I can't remember whether the statement was actually made in Beirut or not, but she talked about the birth pangs of the new Middle East.
That was such an obscenity when people were dying.
Yes.
Now, the United States, you point out, Kathy Sultan, in Tragedy in South Lebanon, a fact that I had forgotten. I'm losing my mind. My memory's not as good as it used to be. But right in the middle of the war, the Israelis were running out of jet fuel. And,
yes.
and they asked Washington,
yes.
they asked Bush for more, and they got $300 million in emergency
right.
jet fuel so
yes.
they could keep bombing.
Yes.
That is an amazing
I think it was. I think I said it was delivered through Scotland, and I don't think they even asked Scotland if they could go through their airspace and to continue on to the Middle East.
Kathy Sultan, you say... you're troubled by the impunity of Israel to attack and use disproportionate force, the impunity of the United States
Absolutely.
To supply Israel and goad Israel into these actions. How do we force international community to hold those actors responsible?
That's a very difficult question, Matt, and I don't pretend to have the answers, but on the other hand, we just cannot sit back and not criticize it and bring it to the attention of the general public in the hopes that eventually we as American citizens will be able to take back our government. We don't have a government that's responsive to us. We have a vice president who responds when asked, well, Mr. Vice President, there are hundreds of thousands of people in the street protesting the war, and his answer is so. And we have a president who is saying, oh, these are just special interest groups and I don't pay attention to them. I don't remember seeing this kind of arrogance on the part of our leaders in past administrations. Surely there has been some level, but this has gone way over the top. And I am surprised that more people aren't outraged. And my hope in raising these questions and hoping that people will read this book and understand the intricacies of our involvement as a U.S. government in another foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East, it's bad enough that we're in Iraq, but that we're trying to dismember other nations in that area. We have to pay attention to what's going on. That's the only way things are going to change, Matt.
Kathy Sultan, a lot of people are holding out hope for Barack Obama, and perhaps that hope is unjustified in this region. He spoke at AIPAC recently. What do you make of Obama's position on this issue?
I was baffled when he went as far as he had, particularly since a few months ago, he also addressed a very powerful group of Jewish leaders in which he said that something, I'm paraphrasing because I don't have the exact wording, but he paraphrased to the effect that if supporting Israel means supporting the Likud right-wing agenda, then that's not something that I'm prepared to do. Now, why he would have almost reversed that and practically threw himself at the feet of AIPAC is totally beyond me. It's one thing to have said some of the usual political rhetoric in a presidential campaign when you're garnering votes. But what's not understood is the fact, first, why he would do it. Because the Democrats, I mean, the Jewish community in this country generally votes Democratic anyway, not Republican. And to say, to mention that Israel, that Jerusalem would be the undivided capital of Israel, this is something that's sacrosanct. Jerusalem belongs to three monotheistic religions. It does not belong to the Jewish religion. And I'm at a loss to explain why he's done that. I had breakfast recently with Robert Fisk in Beirut, and we were 12 in this group. And one of my fellow members were asked Fisk about this, and Fisk said, "Mark my word, when somebody like that makes a comment in public to win a presidency, when he becomes president, if he should become president, his policies won't change." So I think that Barack Obama has gone over a red line, and I'm very pessimistic about any future evolution of a trend towards a peaceful resolution in the Middle East.
Well, you know, I hate to end on a pessimistic note, but that's all the time we have, and that may be the reality. Kathy Sultan, author of Tragedy in South Lebanon, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you very much, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.